Back in 1981, I had the American dream, the beautiful wife, the house in the suburbs, and a beautiful six-year-old son. And one day I went to work, kissed my son goodbye, and never saw him again. In 2 weeks, I became the parent of a murdered child, and I'll always be the parent of a murdered child. I still have the heartache. I still have the rage. I waited years for justice. I know what it's like to be there waiting for some answers. And over those years, I learned how to do one thing really well, and that's how to catch these bastards and bring them back to justice. I become a manhunter. I'm out there looking for bad guys.
Little brother's laying here dead. I don't know what happened.
What is your first name?
Sam. Samuel Wells.
Walked in on that. Still have a hard time with it today.
There was just no sign of life whatsoever.
Can I take a time out?
My boys were very typical little boys, and they were very close to the same age, so they almost looked like triplets. And they were just active, happy little boys.
It was a wonderful childhood, absolutely amazing. I had two younger brothers, Sid and Sam, and a great dad who loved the outdoors. I mean, Colorado, it doesn't get any better than this. We came from very humble roots. I would say we were lower middle class. But when it came to the richness of love in a family, I think we were at the upper scale. Very, very close family.
Sid was fun, outgoing, could be obnoxious at times. Kind of a joking comic, always kind of a funny attitude.
Sid, he's everybody's best friend. Knows no stranger. Very popular in high school, band, good athlete. He was just a amazing guy. Everybody loved him. He was studying journalism and going to the Navy ROTC program there at the University of Colorado as well. Sid was in had a girlfriend at the time named Shauna Redford. After a couple, two or three dates, he calls me up and he goes, Rob, he goes, you're not going to believe this, but I just found out I'm dating Robert Redford's daughter.
Sid and Shauna had been dating for almost 3 years, and they were just fun couple to be around, very much in love.
We had a condo in Boulder, Colorado called the Spanish Towers. It was great because Sid was going to school there so he could live there all through his college days.
Sam moved in the summer of 1983.
He needed a roommate, so I filled in for the summer. Got to hang out and get to know Shauna a little bit better, his girlfriend.
That summer, we still needed a good candidate for a third roommate.
experienced Micah was a new person in our lives. So we didn't know him very well. He was from Akron, Eastern Colorado, graduated from CSU. You know, he had some things going on for him. Thane took the main room downstairs and I had the bedroom upstairs.
They felt that he was a good candidate for a roommate. They found after he did move in that he was not very sociable, and I think he was having trouble coming up with the rent money.
On the afternoon of August 1st, 1983, at about 12:26 in the afternoon, the Boulder Police Communications Center got a report of a man not breathing.
It looks like little brother's laying here dead. I don't know what happened.
Is he breathing at all?
No.
To be the horribly unlucky person to find a loved one murdered is a scene or a snapshot that you'll never be able to forget. It is a gigantic cross to bear for a loved one.
Police and fire officials were met by Sam Wells. At the elevator, Sam took him into the apartment, and on the living room floor of the apartment, they found Sidney Wells dead of an apparent gunshot wound to the head. Shauna Redford just had seen Sid a couple hours before. He was alive and well, and then to come back and find out that he had been killed. You have absolutely horrific news.
At 4 o'clock, my boss called me to the front of the store and said that there was someone that needed to see me. It was a police officer from Boulder.
You're not prepared for anything to happen to your child. You're supposed to nurture those children, and they're your immortality. It's unbearable.
You know, I couldn't cry. I couldn't do anything but just stare at him because I couldn't believe what he was saying. That's how our nightmare started.
On August 1st of 1983, I received a phone call from my brother, Sam. He told me Sid was gone, that he was killed and murdered, and that he walked in and found him.
The first thing the police look for in any type of a homicide scene is sign of a forced entry through the door or a window, or a sign of a struggle. And they didn't see any sign that there had been an obvious burglary, robbery, or assault in this apartment. That leads investigators to think that they should be looking from within. They should be looking at roommates or friends or relatives or people who had access to this apartment, people who had access to Sid Wells. In this case, the police started their investigation with Sam Wells.
They proceeded to asked me all kinds of questions. Questions like, you know, why would you kill your brother? Why would you do something like that? And they decided it was time to give me what they call a paraffin test to find out whether or not you have fired a weapon. And all they could find was campfire smoke, so that was my saving grace.
By mid-afternoon, we determined that Sam Wells was no longer a viable suspect.
We had just gone through losing Sid's dad in 1981, and 2 years later, this tragedy happened. And it was just almost too much for all of us. Of course, I just wanted to know why.
Who'd want to kill Sid, you know?
It is the simple question that all victims ask. Before we can really grieve, before we can close that chapter of our lives, we need to see that person held accountable.
My initial involvement in this case was being assigned to the crime scene. Mr. Wells was found laying face down on the floor, died from what appeared to be a shotgun wound to the back of his head. Because it was such a close contact wound, the blast and the gases from the shell being fired all went into the head. There was very little blood splatter, although there was some.
Crime scene investigators in 1983 used a substance called luminol to look for the presence of blood at a crime scene. Once the police have sprayed a crime scene with luminol, they will turn off the lights and they'll apply essentially a black light to the area that they've sprayed. And if there's a presence or a presumptive presence of blood or any kind of bodily fluid, that scene will light up in a fluorescent color.
We got quite a bit of reaction. Somebody with something with blood on it had been moving around the apartment.
The trail in the apartment went into Thane Smyka's bedroom, and it went into the bathroom.
In the downstairs bathroom, we noticed that there was a red ring in that toilet.
An inference that the police had was that perhaps the shotgun used to murder Sid Wells had been cleaned in that toilet bowl.
Interestingly enough, the bathroom on the first floor was Thane Smyka's bathroom. What was most interesting to us was on the coffee table next to where Sid's body was found, we found a note and an envelope. The envelope had the number $300 written on it. August 1st was rent day. Thane Smyka was due to pay Sid $300 that he was going to take to his mother. We didn't find anything in that envelope.
The note was a note from Thane Smyka, and it was to Sam and Sid Wells, informing them that he had gone home to his parents' house and he'd be back in a couple of days. What was interesting to the police was that there were a number of small spots of blood found underneath the note that Thane Smyka wrote.
It appeared that the note from Thane to Sid and Sam and the envelope had been placed there after Mr. Wells was shot.
Somebody placed that envelope after the murder. After the murder. That puts Thane Smyka as suspect number one.
They say from every murder, there's 7 to 10 other people directly affected. Not just family members, but girlfriends, neighbors, friends, and associates. And when Sid was killed, that number had to be in the hundreds. We all want to know the answers to the questions on what happened to my brother.
At this point, Thane Smyka was our primary suspect. Friends and acquaintances of Mr. Smyka reported him as behaving erratically. They thought that he was using drugs and just kind of going downhill fast. We also interviewed another witness. Jeff Cohen was a friend of Sid's. We learned from Jeff that everybody had been up the night before into the early morning hours of August 1st. He told us that what was supposed to happen that evening or early morning was Thane was supposed to return some money to Sid, and in addition to paying the rent, was also going to give Sid some additional money and some cocaine. Jeff told us that his friend Sid had been selling small amounts of cocaine in the previous months, and that Sid had suspected that Thane Smyka was stealing cocaine from Sid. It's our belief that Thane Smyka that night didn't have the cocaine or the money to give back to Sidney Wells.
I'm the father of a college student, and I think it would be very naive to not think that your college-age son might be trying recreational drugs. He might sell recreational drugs here or there. It's not a reason for someone to kill Sid Wells. It's not a reason for police not to investigate this case. Sid Wells was murdered in cold blood. That's what this case is about.
At this stage of the investigation, Thane Smyka is the focus. Based on the note that Thane Smyka had left his roommates, the police were able to locate him in Akron, Colorado, which is where Thane's parents were living at the time.
This will be a taped interview with Thane, last name Smyka.
Mr. Smyka did not appear to be particularly nervous, didn't appear to be too surprised that the detectives were there, certainly wasn't surprised to learn that his roommate had been killed. There was no emotion shown by Mr. Smyka.
So you say you left about, what time? 10:11, 10. He left the apartment before you did.
Yeah.
Where should the money and coke be?
It should be in the apartment.
Despite what we heard from Thane Smyka, no money was found on Sidney Wells, this person, nor was any money or cocaine found in the apartment.
Several days after the murder of Sid Wells, the police drove back to Akron, Colorado to search the house of Thane Smyka's mother. Thane Smyka was not at his mother's house at the time of the search.
Thane Smyka's mother talked about some not very complimentary character traits. Mrs. Smyka thought that her son may be a psychopath and may very well have been involved in the murder of Sidney Wells. It was pretty significant coming from a parent and especially a mother. We had a search warrant for the house. One of the first areas that we searched was the bedroom closet. We pulled a box off the shelf, and inside that box we found a 20-gauge shotgun. We knew that Mr. Wells had been killed with a 20-gauge shotgun. What added to that suspicion was Thane Smyka's sister, who lived in the house, telling us that they had just cleaned that room and that previous to August 1st, 1983, that gun wasn't in that bedroom. I remember feeling at the time that we'd probably had our man.
In early October 1983, Thane Smyka was arrested for murder in the first degree.
We heard Thane Smyka had been arrested. We were elated, and I thought, oh, you know, got the family settled down, law enforcement did their job. Boom, we're gonna get the rest of the story now and really find out what happened to Sid.
I certainly had a feeling of relief that we had solved the case. But within the next few days, the DA's office, who had approved the arrest warrant for Mr. Smyka, came back to us and said that they felt that there was not enough evidence. As a result, they wouldn't be filing the murder charges against Mr. Smyka. Bail was set and he was released.
In order to help further the investigation, the Boulder District Attorney's Office convened a grand jury into the murder of Sid Wells. At that time, Thane Smyka is essentially out living in society.
At the end of a two-year grand jury run, no indictment was issued by the grand jury.
When we found out they had not indicted him, you know, we couldn't believe it.
shock. Absolute, complete mystification. Grief turned into anger that day.
For this grand jury to spend 2 years and look at a mountain of solid evidence and not indict Thane Smyka, something was wrong.
A few months after the grand jury, we got some documents back from the Boulder DA's office. I started to go through those, and I came upon an agreement that had been signed by the then DA and the lawyer that was representing Thane Smyka. They agreed in advance that there would be no indictment. This represented to me an abuse of the grand jury system. That's not the way the system was supposed to work.
We were left with the pretty empty feeling that, you know, we were never going to get any kind of closure on this.
The detectives felt that Thane Smyka was guilty. Everything pointed to Thane Smyka, but we couldn't touch him because an arrest warrant wasn't issued. It was just difficult to even get out of bed in the mornings. Shauna quit college. She grieved in ways that I can't even imagine.
We found out that the district attorney had guaranteed Thane Smyka would not be indicted by the grand jury. To this day, my family doesn't know why the DA made that deal with Thane Smyka.
Cops are powerless unless there's an indictment, unless that DA's office says, go arrest this guy. So cops can knock on the DA's door every day and say, we have the perpetrator. He's gonna run. If you don't let us arrest him, he's gonna run.
The next thing we hear about Thane Smyka is a few years later, we get a call from the Denver DA's office. What we learned was that Mr. Smyka eventually made his way to Denver, that he had gone to work for a construction company as a bookkeeper. He had written unauthorized checks to himself, and that missing money had been discovered, and the Denver DA's office was able to get an arrest warrant for Mr. Smyka.
Shortly after that arrest warrant was issued, that's pretty much the last we've heard of Thane Smyka.
It's 3 years after the murder. Smyka has disappeared, but Dave Hayes, caring, determined, dedicated cop, never gives up.
Every year, he was bringing more information forward on my brother's case. It could be evidence like the shotgun shells, and it taking all of this evidence and reevaluating it, reanalyzing it, and bringing in new technologies, new forensics in to see how that could be applied in this case. And he would go in every year with new evidence to the DA's.
We wanted to bring the case to conclusion. No matter how long it took, we were going to stay with it.
I started in the Boulder District Attorney's Office in 2009. I started under the new administration with DA Stan Garnett, and sure enough, in the summer of 2009, Dave Hayes showed up on our doorstep with boxes upon boxes upon boxes of the investigative file into the murder of Sid Wells. In December of 2010, 27 years after Sid Wells was murdered, the DA signed off on an arrest warrant accusing Thane Smyka of murder in the first degree.
After getting the warrant, we put together a coordinated search, which included sending detectives to every place where there was members of the Smyka family or close friends of the Smyka family. Unfortunately, the family, without exception, told us they did not know where Thane was and did not know how to locate him.
I think mistakes were made. I think this family has suffered what my family did. Incompetence, bad judgment, mistakes, and that precluded the real bad guy, the guy that killed Sid, from facing justice.
Well, Sid's been gone for 30 years. The things that he's missed out on while Thane's out there and enjoying his life such as it is, no justice in that at all. Sid's unsolved murder has just been agonizing for us. My brother who found Sid, his life has been forever changed. It's almost like he's frozen in that moment in time.
There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about it. Would love to see Thane Smyka arrested and charged duly. It would make me very happy. I'd be probably the happiest guy alive.
Because of a terminal illness, I don't know that I'll live long enough to see a resolution in this case. But I would hope that I can, and I've never given up hope.
Thane Smyka has brown hair and hazel eyes. He may be working as an accountant or bookkeeper. Unconfirmed sightings have placed him in Southern California and in Mexico. If you've seen Thane Smyka or have any information as to his whereabouts, please go online at cnn.com/thehunt. You can remain anonymous. We'll pass your tip on to the proper authorities, and if requested, we'll not reveal your name.
The first time I met Rick McLean was at a meeting at the Alpine Congregation of Jehovah's Witnesses.
He was a ministerial servant, so he had privileges of helping the elders maybe read during the meeting. I thought he was liked by everybody. He was very easygoing.
I could relate with Rick because he worked on high-performance cars. And I've worked on race boats and race cars myself. And so on that level, we had a lot in common. And often, our two families would work together out in the door-to-door ministry.
We started doing family things with them right after their daughter was born. They wanted to go on vacation with us in the summers. They invited us over to dinner a lot, so we ended up doing a lot of things with the McLeans.
He was always wanted to do stuff with us kids, whether it be like, do you guys want to go like play games at the arcade, or do you want to go get ice cream? He was definitely respected in the church. I feel like everyone got along with him. He was definitely trusted, well-liked. I remember when it started, he would always have my brothers and I, do you guys want to come spend the night? So we would spend the night frequently. He would want to tell us like stories. As time went on, that's when he started molesting me. Basically, right in front of my brothers, but they didn't even know it. I mean, lights were off and no one knew what was going on. This started probably around 8. It went on for about, I would say till I was about 13. I didn't really know what to do, so I just didn't say anything.
Pedophiles have a compulsion that they can't deal with. They will risk family, fortune, reputation to satisfy that narcissistic desire.
The first step in his process would be to gain the trust of the parents of the young girls he intended on victimizing. So he would leverage that fact of how close-knit a Jehovah's Witness community is. He would build on that to get the parents to bring children to him. Finally, in the spring of 04, the first victim confronted him and said point blank, "You molested me." And he admitted to it in front of her, in front of the adults, and in front of his wife. That was the dam-busting moment, and the floodgates opened from then.
Nancy McLean called me and told me someone had come forward and told them that she had been molested by Rick. I says, "Oh, well, don't worry, we love Rick." I actually remember doing that. But then I think I realized it sunk in. She said, "You need to talk to your daughter." I called her up to my bedroom, and as soon as I said it, I knew that it had happened to her. I could just tell by her face, by the look on her face. So, and then I said, "Did anything happen to you?" And she said, "Yes." And she started crying.
It's just something that I just tried to forget about for so long. At that point, I had just, like, suppressed all of this. Like, you know, you block out so much.
We were very angry. Immediately, we wanted Rick caught.
Absolute betrayal. I just couldn't imagine anything worse.
More victims started coming forward through summer of 2004. So at this point, McLean's been charged with 16 counts of sexual assault on 4 children. Rick McLean's family left him. They packed up all their stuff and moved out and left him on his own.
He wrote us a letter apologizing to us and asking for us to remember the good Rick. But I really feel there was no good in him.
He started liquidating his businesses. Sold off race cars, sold off the properties that he owned. And I kind of believe he had a plan for a long time. He, some level, knew this day was going to come. At one point, Rick McLean called his wife and asked her and the kids to meet him off of a particular off-ramp in Southwest Riverside County. They went out there and they met, and he said something along the lines of, "I can't go to prison, so the easiest thing for me to do is just to get out of everybody's life, so I'm gonna disappear, you're never gonna see me again." Rick McLean was revealed as a molester.
I could not believe that as hard as we had tried to give our kids a good life, that these things had happened.
It destroyed my family. I mean, how would it not? Just basically because of this sick individual.
When this young girl confronted him and outed him for the monster that he is, very shortly thereafter, he disappeared. One morning, his father-in-law wakes up. He had dumped his truck in the father-in-law's driveway. Wallet, cell phone, some letters for the family are sitting in the truck. We also found a treasure map. There was a schematic on it. There was instructions about where to find this buried container. And McLean wrote this cryptic note to his family. Said, "If something happens to me, Someone will contact you and tell you where to find the house where this treasure is buried. So on the map, there was a number, 614. We knew it was part of a house number. We weren't sure that we had the complete number. We had no idea what street it was on, didn't know what city it was in, or even what state it was in. We looked and looked and looked and worked with the Postal Service and looked at maps. We're never able to really break the code of the map. We were analyzing his last business transactions, and we were able to account for everything except for one car. It was described as a 3/4 scale replica 1955 Chevy race car. Pretty unique car. And I was actually able to backtrack all the way to the guy who originally built the cars and lives down in Florida. He calls me and says, hey, this guy over in Daytona Beach has one of these cars. So I get a hold of that guy, and he says that he bought the car from this dealership in Georgia. Well, I talked to the guy in Georgia. He bought the car from an auction in Arizona in 2005. Now I'm excited because this falls into my timeline. So I end up with this huge stack of paperwork from all of the auctions that happened in Scottsdale in 2005. Found the car, pulled the information. I didn't recognize the name, but as soon as I read the address, it was biggest, most exciting moment of the investigation. Oh my God, I decoded the treasure map because the address was the parcel from the treasure map. Perfect, absolute match for the sketch that he had left behind in the truck. I'm thinking this might be my one shot to break this thing open and get this guy in custody. What we found was just a retired guy living by himself in this house.
They showed me a picture and they said, do you know this person? And I knew it was McLean. A longtime neighbor brought Rick to my house, and Rick was going through a divorce. I invited Rick to stay in the spare bedroom. I didn't know he had a different side. I only feel badly that I helped perpetuate his freedom.
It's really sad how these guys work society, how they are able to exist amongst us and constantly count on the charity and goodwill of people.
We used the map to identify the exact spot on the side of the house where McLean had indicated on the treasure map that something was buried. We called in a special forensics team. Unfortunately, when they dug it up, there was nothing there, but there was an indentation in the ground that showed that a container had been buried there just as he had described in the treasure map. Our best guess is that he hid some money or maybe some other important documents in there to try to keep him away from law enforcement. Once he decided to leave the house where he was staying, he dug it up and took it with him.
The hardest part about this case is that I know after 9 years that this guy is still out there. His use for the Jehovah's Witness church was his access to victims. There are several other churches and organizations in the country that would take him in, that would give him similar access to victims.
What most people don't understand about pedophiles is the depth of their cunning. You have to live in society while you're molesting your best friends, your neighbors, or your relatives' children. They're the vampires of our children that live amongst us.
I figured they would find Rick. I didn't think it would be 10 years later. We're still wondering, you know, where is he? Are we gonna find him? We don't even know how many kids he's molested over the last however many years.
Best case scenario that could happen is he's caught as soon as possible. Trial, life in prison. And prison population has a way of taking care of business.
Rick McLean enjoys camping and is a fan of traditional country music. He's a night owl. If you've seen Rick McLean or have any information as to his whereabouts, please go online at cnn.com/thehunt. You can remain anonymous. We'll pass your tip on to the proper authorities, and if requested, we'll not reveal your name.
You know, I don't even have dreams of this. It's like the same recurring dream where he's there and I can't get help and, you know, It would be nice just to find him so he can get what he deserves and go to jail and not hurt any more kids.
I'm sure Rick McClain is out there. I'm sure that he's got children in his crosshairs. He's not gonna stop. He's out there trying to convince you to let him have your children so that he can rape them.